KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
We still have a long way to go, but this bipartisan blueprint is a major breakthrough.
We had a gun bazaar break out on the streets of Seattle outside of a gun buyback. I mean, that was just insane.
Mayor McGinn talking about that very strange gun bazaar, as he called it, that occurred outside the gun buyback on Saturday. We'll talk about that in our chat room. And we're going to start with the Gang of Eight U.S. Senators. They always have to be called a gang of that because everybody wants to reference back to the Chinese communist era for reasons I don't understand. But anyways, the Gang of Eight U.S. Senators, including Charles Schumer there, compiled a bipartisan proposal on immigration reform. That's the number one issue in the Senate right now, interestingly enough, I guess because they've pushed the sequestration and the other budget issues off a little bit so they can have something to disagree about that they both think they're going to win on, perhaps, both being both sides. In any event, how does it affect the nation? How does it affect Washington State? Matt Barreto is political science professor at the University of Washington. He's also co-founder of a polling firm called Latino Decisions. He joins us to talk about this proposal and the overarching issue. Thanks for being here.
Sure. Thanks, Steve.
And I asked you this before the break. I just ask you again, do you know students in particular who are affected by this question of citizenship?
Yeah, you know, there are a number of students, not just at the University of Washington, but across our state, who are not documented, who were brought here at a very young age by their parents and are the so-called dreamers that we've heard so much about. And this summer, when President Obama announced the change in Department of Homeland Security policy called Deferred Action, essentially the executive order version of the DREAM Act, we started to see a number of students across the state come out, figure out how they needed to register for that, how they would take advantage of that. And it was even a point of discussion in one of the gubernatorial debates when asked, you know, these students who now will have legal status, should they be able to also obtain driver's licenses so they can drive to campus? So there's a strong presence of students. They've been very active, very vocal. And I think now that we're talking about comprehensive reform, it goes beyond just those students and looks at the millions of other immigrant families who are here.
You know, it's interesting. So here we have the House. This is today. This just came out one hour ago. A secretive group of House members from both parties is racing to complete an immigration bill in the next 2 weeks with an eye toward introducing legislation before President Obama's State of the Union address February 12th. Of course, the president, I don't think he's spoken yet, but he's speaking today.
Today in Nevada, right.
On this issue, and he's going to Nevada, of course, because Nevada was one of those states that he won in part because of the Latino vote. So this is politics. Is it also going to give us some reform, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, this is interesting about the House trying to move. I think that there are certain folks in the House, especially on the Republican side, who are probably a bit worried about too strong of a bipartisan bill coming out of the Senate. If a bill comes out of the Senate that is truly bipartisan with strong support, it'd be very difficult to stop that momentum in the House. And so I think you probably have some posturing from some more conservative Democrats and conservative Republicans maybe who are coming together on a bill here that maybe won't be as far-reaching as the bill in the Senate. That'd be my guess. I haven't read that news closely. But the Senate has been far, far more involved and taken a leadership role on immigration issues over the last few years.
Representative Mario Diaz-Balart said in a statement, the senator's principles are compatible with discussions in the House, but he wouldn't give details at this point. He's also got John Carter and Sam Johnson of Texas, and Democrats Luis V. Gutierrez, Zoe Lofgren, and Xavier Becerra.
Javier Becerra.
Look at me. Javier Becerra.
Welcome to
the new world.
Welcome to the new world. That's right.
Javier Becerra.
That's a very balanced group of House members, actually. So if it's those folks, especially with people like Luis Gutierrez from Chicago, I would expect that group of House members will propose a bill that's very similar to the one in the Senate. Now, one of the interesting things there is a couple of Texas House members. On the Senate side, neither of the two senators from Texas, the state with the second largest number of immigrants after California, endorsed that proposal yesterday, John Cornyn and the newly elected Ted Cruz. In fact, they both spoke against it and they're from a state that would really have a lot to gain from something like this.
So the critiques I heard, so the four basic pillars, create a path to citizenship for unauthorized immigrants that are already here, but contingent upon securing the border and combating visa overstays. That seems to be where the rubber in the road are in conflict there.
No, absolutely. That is the biggest glaring question mark, I think. What does that mean, contingent upon securing our borders? I mean, we could have these debates and fights forever. The border is secure. The border's not secure. The number of unauthorized immigrants is decreasing every year. And there have been increases in border security. And so I think there needs to be some specific metrics attached to that before you see support from a lot of different immigrant groups. That if that's not there, what you're going to get is a bill that just does increases in border security, increases in troops, the technology they stated. And visa overstayers, again, this is a very complicated thing. How do you track down those visa overstayers? You know, one of our most famous visa overstayers was Governor Schwarzenegger, who for a time was an undocumented immigrant because he didn't fill out the follow-up paperwork to say, yeah, hey, I'm going to stay in the United States. So that's a category, again, that is very slippery. And I think we'd like to see some more precision there as that bill moves forward.
Well, I heard one opponent saying, why would we even do this until we secure our borders? And again, he didn't define that. That had been the argument for the past, what, 8 years?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in 2006, we really saw the immigration debate heat up. There was a bill in the House and the Senate on immigration reform, again in 07. And since that time, the opposition has said, no, we need to secure the border. The border's not secure. Why do we want to reform immigration if we can't control the borders? And there has been a lot of effort since then. The states that our border states have used additional National Guard troops to go and assist. There have been increases in the amount of technology and funding for border fences and other sorts of items. And there have been increases in border troops. And so there have been increases over the years. The question is, what exactly does that mean to say the border is secure? There are always going to be things like drug shipments and other sorts of smuggling happening. It's impossible to get 100% security there. That's a lesson we know. We have to be, you know, as vigilant as possible. But there are 10 to 12 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States as a part of America. Some of them students, as we said. Some of them have been here for 20 years. They own houses. And it's unfair to those folks to say we've got some sort of ambiguous border security issue before we can even start to address your situation.
Here's a little clip from one of the folks involved in this.
The last time the United States tried an amnesty, it caused a surge of new illegal immigration as aliens came across the border saying, you know, wanting to wait for the next amnesty, even though we said this is the one and only time back in 1986. They came knowing, and they were right, that another amnesty would be proposed. The same thing is going to happen again.
I was working a little too fast this morning. I didn't grab that guy's name, but he was in yesterday's report on All Things Considered. Now, that's the other part of this. Oh, you give amnesty, you're going to get more people coming through. Matt Barreto, as co-founder of the polling firm Latino Decisions, do people see anything along the lines of this proposal as amnesty, and is that a negative?
No, I think that was probably Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State from Kansas, who's been a very outspoken critic of immigration reform.
Good job on that, Matt.
And he actually went to the same high school as me. Oh. I'm ashamed to say. He's definitely one of my intellectual foes. We have sparred many times. Anyway, you know, that argument and calling it amnesty is a misnomer. First of all, it's not amnesty. The folks who are going to get status adjustment through this process are going to have to wait a very long time. They're going to have to fill out a lot of forms. They're going to have to pay fines. They're going to have to pay restitution. They're going to have to pay some taxes back on federal taxes that they may not have paid.
Is that what you mean by restitution?
And so, yeah, there's a lot of different things that are going to go into the balancing out of that. It's not just a blanket forgiveness for this policy. And it's also incorrect to say that there was a boom in migration following the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act that President Reagan signed, because it was listed as a one-time offer. It didn't say, and anyone else who comes after that will also get to apply. All of those people who have come since have come generally for new opportunities for their families. The same reasons that other immigrants have come, and they have come knowing that they have to live in the fear of deportation.
Well, his implication is, oh, you know, America was soft once, America will be soft again.
Well, that's been 26 years now. And so, you know, it's ridiculous to say that these immigrants are perfectly willing to live in the shadows for 26 years because they know one day, you know, Marco Rubio and Bob Menendez are going to come along and provide this bill. I mean, it's a ridiculous argument. And they have faced a number of barriers in the interim years.
When you look at some of the proposals, one of them was have to learn English. What do you think of that?
That's something that when we ask Latino immigrants in our surveys, how important is that? We get 99% of people saying that that's a very important skill and something that they wish to attain.
But a criteria by which you become a citizen?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there still is general support for that. What needs to happen is that there needs to be opportunities for that to prosper. I mean, when we were talking about German and Italian immigrants 150 years ago or 100 years ago, there were classes. There were state-sponsored classes that you could come into. In fact, the political parties would get you and help you learn English. And now we've seen those decrease. And so there are far, far less opportunities for those things. But that's something immigrants support. They know. And again, it's not that you have to be able to take college prep courses in English. You have to pass some basic minimal requirements that you can read and write and hold a conversation in English. And generally, that's something that immigrants support. They strive to be able to, you know, do that to achieve the American dream.
Is that part of what it is to be an American, to be of a common language? I mean, there is that push-pull on this issue, right?
Yeah, I think that the push and pull is whether or not your second language, regardless of what that is, whether it's Korean or Spanish or Arabic or any other language, that second language doesn't have to be lost. So often the debate around language becomes this nationalistic debate that English is the only language that we can speak. And again, when we ask surveys of Latino immigrants, how important is it to learn English? Almost everyone says it's important. On the same time, we say, how important is it to be able to retain Spanish or speak Spanish with your children? Everybody says, well, that's also important. And so English is seen as a language that can increase prosperity and opportunities. And so that's something that people do strive for. The problem is that so many times there's not those chances. We don't have English classes at every community center and after school program for immigrants to participate in.
We're talking about the proposal from the senators on immigration reform. President Obama is going to lay out his proposals. The House is working on theirs, we find out today. Matt Barreto is political science professor at the UW and co-founder of a polling firm called Latino Decisions. A couple more questions on this issue and then locally or statewide. One of the other pillars of this proposal is improving the legal immigration system to attract the world's best and brightest. What's the political calculation here?
Well, you know, there'd been a lot of run-up in this to find out what are the business needs of immigration. What does the business community need? And there were lots of discussions with folks, including from here in Washington State, as well as in Silicon Valley in California, about the need to increase opportunities for math, science, engineering, these professional skills where there just doesn't seem to be a pipeline for whatever reason in the United States. And so that has been part of the push to say that if businesses here in the United States wish to prosper, not have to outsource, but to insource, to hire people here in the United States, can we create an opportunity that they can go after those best and brightest to come here and contribute to these companies? At the same time, the bill outlines another classification of workers who, and those are ones who are competing for jobs that no one here wants to do. That if you can't hire for a position, that if you try to find U.S.-born citizens and people don't want those jobs, is it then okay to say, okay, we need immigrants to come and fill these additional positions that are very important and relevant to our economy? And those are ones that are very important here in Washington State and Central and Eastern Washington.
Right. And in the past, we had programs. Is this essentially opening the way for a new Bracero program?
I think there's going to be some changes to the guest worker programs, to the types of visas, the number of visas that are permitted. That's always been a point of contention because on the one side, some people have said, look, don't give any of these immigrants legal status. Just give them a legal a visa program that keeps them as temporary or as renewable, but they'll never become American citizens. And that has been met with resistance from the immigrant community, who has said, no, we live here. We participate in the communities. We're a part of the community. We want to become citizens. But there is a need to revise the program so that it makes sense that farm owners and other in the ag industry are hiring people, that they have the right number of visas, that they can recruit labor and hire people and not have to go through the sort of black markets of undocumented labor.
So what's your sense? What's your sense of where we are today?
Well, I think the announcement by the bipartisan senators was very, very important. You know, that was a good group of senators. You had a lot of heavyweights in there like John McCain and Charles Schumer, and you had people who have worked on this issue in the past. You had an equal number of Republicans and Democrats. And I think that sends a signal that the Senate is serious, that this isn't just the most, quote, liberal senators who are working on this. But this is really something. If the Senate can get some consensus and can push through a bill that maintains many of these principles, then I think you're going to see those same Senate House members we mentioned earlier become more serious about it. The House is always going to be the place where there's more worry about it, because there are more conservative Republicans who in some cases chair the committees. People like Lamar Smith from Texas, very, very conservative on this issue, who chair committees that the bills would have to go through. But if there's enough consensus, almost like the fiscal cliff vote, which was 89-8 or something, if there's enough consensus in the Senate, you might be able to get it through for a vote in the House and say, you know, you can vote no if you want to, but let's at least bring it up for a vote. If that happens, I think there are enough Republicans in the House who will join Democrats in voting for it.
By the way, what impact does this have on the, if at all, on the Washington State Legislature, where conservatives are also in charge of committees in the Senate?
Well, you know, here in Washington State, there would be, you know, possibly a couple hundred thousand, maybe 200,000 people who might be eligible. I haven't looked at the latest numbers for a program like this. A high percentage of those are in central and eastern Washington. And so you have people there who are participating in the economy, but they don't have opportunities as other American citizens do. And so this could have that ability to increase the Latino presence here in the Western Washington, the Asian presence of American citizens who eventually are becoming into the electorate, running for office, participating in all walks of life.
Yeah, issues we talked about during this last year. You know, last question, Senator McCain said yesterday that the Hispanic vote should be a Republican vote. How accurate is that today?
Well, you know, they did terrible in 2012, and he's right that they can do a lot better than they did in 2012. In 2012, they were in the 20s. It was about 25% for the Republicans and 75% for the Democrats. And if you go back just to 2004, that's only 8 years ago, George W. Bush in his reelection got close to 40%. So the Republican Party is never going to win in a majority of the Hispanic and Latino vote. But if they continue to only win 20, 25, 30%, they will be in serious trouble. It's going to make it hard to ever win Colorado or in the future Arizona, which they're currently winning. They may start losing Arizona. So they need to make inroads. They need to have a more positive image. They need to stop scapegoating immigrants. And this is a start. If they're involved in this bill seriously and it's a true bipartisan bill, then I think they can take some of the credit for it and say, we, you know, helped move this along and we're not the bad guys you thought we were.
I wonder if they have to do this quickly in order to get that credit.
No, it's got to happen in 2013. I think most estimates are, you know, the bill needs to move through by the end of summer. If it doesn't, once you get around to the 2014 midterms, something like immigration reform is not going to probably come onto the table in 2014. So I think most people are looking at a vote by July. If you don't have that vote by July and then you have the summer recess, people start talking politics, 2014 midterms, it gets very dangerous.
Professor Matt Barreto is at the University of Washington, the Political Science Department, co-founder of the polling firm Latino Decisions. Thank you, sir.
Sure. Thanks, Steve.
And later today, the president will speak on immigration reform, and we'll have coverage of that as the day goes on. KUOW FM Seattle. A look at the perhaps surprising design of market economies in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley and its evening and weekend MBA program, offering a Saturday option for full-time working professionals from outside the Bay Area to earn a Berkeley MBA. Seattle information session on January 30th. More information at haas.berkeley.edu.
45 degrees with light rain around the Seattle area. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1025. What's the buzz these days in Seattle? The city's recent gun buyback? The Sonics, will they or won't they be returning to Seattle? And Seattle hip-hop artist Macklemore goes from the thrift shop to the top of the charts. We're going to take the cultural pulse of the city with local musicians Sir Mix-a-Lot and John Roderick in 20 minutes.
But first, take a look at markets and the design of markets. Markets are natural, are they not? We're going to talk about that with Alex Marshall. He's the author of a new book, The Surprising Design of Market Economies. He's also the author of How Cities Work, Beneath the Metropolis, a senior fellow at the Regional Plan Association in New York City. Thanks for being here.
It is so nice to be here, Steve.
Yes, you're violating everything we know, the natural market. You and I come together, I sell you something, you give me something in return. I believe that was handed down by God.
That is the usual discourse, isn't it? There is a habit of speaking of markets as if they were natural things and as if they, again, somehow existed like the law of gravity or the oceans or a state of nature. And I used to have that opinion. But various things drew me into it. And the more I poked at it, the more I have concluded that that's really a false conception. Yes.
Well, you bring our good friends Hobbes and Locke into the equation.
Yes.
And you also talk about President Obama as being somebody who perhaps, because he was at the University of Chicago so much, maybe of the persuasion that markets are a natural occurrence.
I think that in the past he has spoken of and acted as if markets were sort of just natural and that all government can do is regulate them. But I'm cheered up in that I think I've seen a change in his discourse in the last year or two, or even in the last few months.
Well, some of the chapters I thought had been written in this book were written by President Obama.
Huh.
The arguments about how we're all in this thing. You didn't build that.
Yes.
I believe you. I know he was trying to make a more sophisticated comment, but the you didn't build that is part of what you're arguing in this book.
It really is. It really is. It's very similar in that you may build your business, but you didn't build the road. You didn't make the laws that create property. You didn't make the laws that allow you to create a corporation, which is really a government entity. So you depend on all this structures that government build. And my big point with the book is that, you know, these are public creations and we should talk about them more.
Right, so what do they mean when they say markets are natural? Because they are not discounting the role of humans in affecting those systems.
I think conventional economists, which are sort of also tend to be centered around the University of Chicago, do in some ways discount the role of government. It's almost like they have blinders on that they don't really see that. And so when you bring it up, they just tend to dismiss it, even though to me it's sort of unquestionable.
Well, what were the first markets, do you suppose?
I think that, you know, they're the institution of a market fair, like the public market. That there, you know, you have the famous Pike Place Market here in Seattle, which I talk about some in the book.
Yeah, but I mean, even earlier. I mean, we're talking about farmers. Early farmers grow enough grain to sell, and they say to their friend, "Give me a pig for this bushel of grain." Is that a market?
That would be an example of an early market. Yeah.
Now, why isn't that a natural? Even back then, why isn't that a natural occurrence?
Well, I think whenever you have a market,
of course, we should define natural.
I know. Whenever you have a market, you have a buying and selling. I mean, first of all, do you have money? When you know, money is actually took sort of thousands of years to come into being.
I know that's why I was bartering. I mean, is bartering the first market?
Yeah, and you could say bartering is a market, but if I trade you for your pig, right? Now, who decides that it's your pig?
You and me together, because we're natural men.
And who keeps me from taking your pig or hitting you on the head for it?
Our basic altruism, by which we want each of us to live in a world where you don't have to worry about me doing the same thing. That's what they mean by natural markets, right? They mean sort of like altruism and self-interest.
And I, you know, and
I should not even say all.
Maybe I bridge the difference here between Locke and Hobbes in that I say people put into place something called government to make sure that I don't hit you in the head and take your pig, or to make sure that you do indeed own that pig. And I think there is a natural feeling. People have impulses of cooperation as well as competition. And to some extent, government can come out of the cooperative impulses. And you may call it by various names, but it ends up being something like government that makes sure that you can have organized buying and selling. And even at the very most simplistic nature, you need something called government to make that happen.
Alex Marshall is author of the book, The Surprising Design of Market Economies. You point out something here which is interesting to think about, in that early major property owners in feudal societies and others, but early major property owners were not comfortable leaving their land because it could be taken.
Yes, yes. They were tied to the land. In a way, they were serfs, just like the serfs they employed. Their serfs couldn't leave their land legally, but they couldn't leave either, really. They couldn't just go to London and sort of live off the rents or to Paris, because there wasn't a monetized economy in that way where you could just get rent from your lands. You had to stay there, and you were tied to it.
And the early enforcements of property ownership, property rights, mm-hmm. were also tied to structures of human
structures of government, and the evolution of property. You know, property is long and interesting. I talk about the Domesday Book in medieval England, which was a book that basically it was done by the king in 1070 or so after the Norman invasion. But it basically classified it basically listed everything that existed in England at the time, and said that I, the king, own it. And you would not think that this would be helpful in developing property rights, but it actually was, because it was the first time that everything had been thought of as being owned by somebody and listed in a book. And so over the centuries, people would talk about going to the book. If there was an argument about who owned something, then you would go to the book and see who was listed as owning it. And technically, actually, the king still owned it. But, you had use of it. And so this, out of this, helped develop our system of public records that basically can prove you own something.
Let's touch on Hobbes and Locke for a minute here, okay. Because you do say, my friends, Hobbes and Locke.
Yes.
Hobbes said that even absolute tyranny was better than no government at all. And Locke is basically a natural rights kind of guy. God hath certainly appointed government to restrain the partiality and violence of men. But he's again looking at this natural order of things. Locke also turns out to be somebody who maybe didn't live by his convictions, huh?
Yes. He was a stockholder in the London Slave Company. And he actually even viewed slavery as kind of something that occurred, quote, naturally. It troubles me that I am not a fan of John Locke, because I'm a great admirer of Thomas Jefferson, and Thomas Jefferson admired John Locke. But, Locke, when you read him, he sounds just kind of phony. You know, he sort of bases everything back to God and says, oh, well, in a state of nature, God created this, and therefore, I mean, he sounds sort of like a chamber of commerce guy trying to sort of justify something that's not really that justifiable.
Well, Thomas Jefferson justified his holding of slavery in part by seeing it as beyond some sort of a, among other things, a market.
True, but, as a native Virginian, I have to defend him. He was a great opponent of slavery his entire life, and did actually work very hard to try to get rid of it. And so I sometimes feel we put too much of the historical burden of slavery upon this man.
You and Meacham, who that's what he was writing in his latest book, too.
Yeah.
But he did own slaves.
Yes, he did.
Well, when you look at cities, you write about mm-hmm. this in your book. You have you looked at sewer structures, the infrastructure of sewers and roads. Mm-hmm. You see in that the surprising design of a market economy.
Yes.
What are you seeing in that that's, I guess, being missed by the people who, you know, criticize it?
Yes. I didn't quite get your drift there. Can you say that one
more time? What are the people who disagree mm-hmm. that markets are first and foremost human constructions?
Yes.
What are they missing in understanding roads, the "you built it" argument?
I think in a lot of ways some things work so well that we stop seeing them. And I opened the book with the lovely Prospect Park near my home in Brooklyn, which seems to be almost like a state of nature. It has rolling hills and streams and, you know, mini mountains, and it's been there 150 years. And you really do start to think, well, this is such a wonderful state of nature. It's so great that they, quote, preserved it. And really, it's only when you study it to really – it's completely created. You know, they brought in the lakes and the streams and the mountains, and it's actually connected to the New York City water supply. There's nothing natural about it. And if you stop – not only was it created, but you have to maintain it. And if you stop maintaining it, then it silts up and goes away. And so I think our markets are like that. I mean, people just accept for granted that we have roads that you can drive on between cities. That was a huge public endeavor and one that took a lot of work. And I'm not talking about the interstates. I'm just talking about basic roads between cities. And, you have to kind of commend these guys because there wasn't anything natural about it. It took a lot of hard work to create the public road system.
And this is a coming together of individuals with different interests.
Yes.
But their basic interest in coming together is to what end?
Well, I think we do have short-term interest and long-term interest, and we get better societies and government when we can put our long-term interests together. It's when people want to have prosperity, they want to be safe, they want to be secure. And it's hard work doing those things, but we progress as a society when we can do them. And I think we progress economically as well.
You were looking at education and where it fits into the idea of the larger design of markets.
Yes. It really is fascinating because public education is something we completely take for granted, but it was only achieved through really a half century of war of hard work. And the debate around healthcare in the 1830s, I'm sorry, the debate around education in the 1830s and 40s and 50s was very similar to the debate about healthcare today. People in Pennsylvania and Virginia and New York in the 1830s, people said, why should I have to pay for my neighbor's child to learn to read and write? That's not my job. And other people said, we are better as a society. We are better as a democracy. We are more prosperous if everyone can read and write.
The argument you're making in the surprising design of market economies mm-hmm. is that each step along the way is a human choice.
Yes.
And that goes for international relations as well and international debates about yeah. how we get along and how we move goods and services across. Yeah. Is it, in your mind, as you look at this, is that the next arena that we challenge the notion of natural markets?
Yes.
In international law?
Commentators like Tom Friedman of the New York Times, they speak about the flat earth world, and they talk about the global economy as if it somehow just occurs and we just have to submit to it. But the institutions of the global economy were and are put into place by human hands. They are physical structures like satellites and cables. And there are legal structures having to do with international law and treaties. And none of that is predetermined. And we need more public conversations about the kind of markets we have. That's really the object of the book.
We're not going to scratch at the surface and find some natural system at the bottom. We're always going to find human decisions.
Yeah, it's like an onion. You keep peeling away these human things, and you, at the bottom, there's nothing left. There's no natural market down there at the bottom that I've been able to find.
Journalist and senior fellow at the Regional Plan Association in New York City, Alex Marshall. His book is The Surprising Design of Market Economies. He's at the Elliott Bay Bookstore February 1st at 7 p.m. to talk about these issues. And came in today to talk about them with us. Thanks a lot.
You know, it's great to be here, and looking forward to speaking Friday at LA Bay, because, you know, that's a storied institution that's kind of famous around the country. So it's going to be great to be there.
And did not occur naturally.
Yes.
This is
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Seattle Zeitgeist in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hubbard Street Dance Chicago, performing two works by Israeli choreographers, February 9th at the Paramount Theater. More information at stgpresents.org.
Haiti is plagued by poverty and natural disasters, but it was once known for Club Med and vacations. The Caribbean country now wants to recover by reclaiming its status as a tourist destination.
Don't just send money through a wire or through an NGO for us. Come and experience Haiti, because we have so much to showcase.
Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, committed to producing safe, healthy milk that starts with maternity programs with pure feed and fresh water for healthy baby cows. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
45 degrees in Seattle under a cloudy sky with scattered light rain. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:40. Some thoughts on reinventing Detroit in 30 minutes.
So, today in the chat room, we're going to talk with a couple of musicians, but do not take the fact that they are musicians to mean that they cannot wax on many an issue. John Roderick is songwriter. I don't know why I even said that, because you know. John Roderick is songwriter, singer, and guitarist of the Long Winters. His weekly podcast is Roderick on the Line, wherein he is on the line with famous internet personality Merlin Mann. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you, Steve.
And Sir Mix-a-Lot is a Seattle-based rapper, songwriter, producer, and MC. He's also Anthony Ray, but I am going with Sir.
Thank you. I will be Sir.
So I was wondering how you all reacted to the gun buyback program that we saw all over the news this weekend. And in particular, I know if you were like me, you saw the news. I was struck by the sort of the bazaar that took place outside of the buyback,
yeah, where people buying guns from the people there to sell guns.
I love it. The mayor was a little aghast at it, but I was thinking, isn't this
pure Americana?
Some kid bought a missile launcher, I heard.
He brought one.
Oh, brought one.
No, he did. You're right. He bought it, and then they said, you know.
But now there was something they had stacked up that was like 6 feet long.
Yeah, that was it. It had been used, too,
wow.
They said.
Interesting.
Should they have expected that in America today? Do you think that, you offer up a gun bazaar and a gun bazaar will occur?
Yeah, I think they probably should have. I mean, it's not quite like Oman, but it's a gun bazaar, right?
Yeah, they weren't there to give the guns to somebody. They were there to sell guns.
Yeah, so, top bidder.
Yeah, exactly. So
I saw folks pulling up when I was standing there, and I saw more than a few, and I know I'm characterizing them. I saw more than a few folks in station wagons, we would call them that, with hatchbacks, middle American wives.
Yep.
And in the back were like three rifles and a couple of handguns. And I just was, perplexed by what was going on there. People have guns just stored in places they haven't gotten rid of them.
Yeah, rusty guns leaning in the corner of their living room. But you know, the thing is, you buy a bunch of rusty shotguns, but if you take one gun off the street that could be used like to actually shoot somebody, you probably saved the city $500,000 in cost.
So you liked the gun buyback notion.
I have a question about it, though. Do they, when people sell these guns to the state, I would say back, but they didn't buy them from the state. So when they sell these guns to the state, does the state ask, who are you, where are you from, where'd you get the gun? Because if they do, they're not going to get the guns that are committing the crimes, right?
Right, and they don't.
Right.
They check on the gun afterwards for whether it's got serial numbers. And there, I can't remember the rule on guns that had serial numbers scratched out, went on a different path than the other guns, but I'm not recalling the rule now. But I don't think they vet the individual that much. But there was there was a criticism by one of the gun buyers out on the street that said, oh, look, you're just going to encourage people to steal guns.
Yeah, well, they'll steal them and give them back, right?
So they'll steal them and then bring them down to get a Target voucher.
If they ask who are you, you're going to get, you know, Susie Homemaker's gun that she's not using. That's not necessarily stopping any crime.
Do you think it was a good program? Do you think it's getting one gun off the street a good thing?
I don't look at it like we're getting guns off the street. I think we like to say that because it sounds really, you know, it's the buzzword, but we're actually just giving people money for guns. The guns that come off the street are going to have scratched off serial numbers and stuff like that. I do rap music, and I know some crooks, and I've never seen any. I've never met one that said, I'm going to go down and register this Glock. It just doesn't work like that. So, I mean, it's cool you're getting guns out of the way that people would have otherwise left hanging around, and they could be stolen. I get that part of it, but I don't know that these are the guns that we're looking for.
By the way, I think you just came up with your next hit. Register this gun.
Yeah. My homies be registering them rifles, man.
Anthony Ray, Sir Mix-a-Lot, is a Seattle-based musician. His 1992 hit, Baby Got Back, went platinum. John Roderick is a singer, songwriter, and podcaster. Roderick on the line. He also plays with the Long Winters.
Nothing about me has gone platinum.
Not yet.
That's not what she said.
I have a crown that's gold.
All right. Super Bowl. Actually, before I go there, I want one other question. You know, here we have the next day, we have the shooting in a lounge. What is that, 25th and Cherry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It makes the effort both poignant and sad. We buy these guns back, and yet still, crimes are...
Because you're not buying the right guns. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, I hate to say it, but run an ad. All you crackheads, come down. No questions asked. Real talk. I mean, let's be honest. That's where it comes from. You know, I can go outside. I'm in the U District right now. I can go outside and buy a gun and not have to walk in a gun store. And if I were going to commit a crime, I wouldn't use one of my guns at home, right?
Set up a table next to the needle exchange.
Yeah.
Or just up the street where the crack is sold.
And that sounds ridiculous, but it's real. I mean, that's where the guns are. That's where the guns that are committing these crimes are.
Well, that is the argument from the folks that we talked to who were buyers and sellers of guns, the gun collectors. They're looking and they're saying, look, I'm happy to give somebody money for these guns because some of them are interesting guns, mm-hmm. but I don't know that we're reducing crime. But the other side says, look, one gun off the street, one less potential.
We're not reducing that kind of crime, but I think the incidents that make the newspapers where a kid takes a gun out of the closet and takes it to school—
Yeah.
We are kind of making an impact if Susie Homemaker's shotgun gets...
Yeah. All the other kids with the pumped up kicks, you better... No, I better stop that. Get in trouble.
Are you a Super Bowl? Are you watching the Super Bowl this weekend?
Definitely, even though I do believe my Seahawks should have been there, but okay.
They were very close.
Deal with it. Atlanta's garbage. They got beat, so that's... I'm happy.
They celebrated 30 seconds too soon.
Yeah.
Who are you rooting for?
San Francisco.
Because it's West Coast or because you like them better?
Two reasons. One, prior to the Seahawks moving to the NFC, I was a Niners fan, so I always wanted the Niners-Seahawks Super Bowl. Then when the Seahawks moved into the Niners division, obviously I had to stop rooting for the Niners, pull for the Seahawks. Since the Hawks are out, there's a reason to go for the Niners. And I think the NFC West is the best division in football, and I want the Niners to prove it. So that way when the Seahawks whoop that ass next year, we'll look even better.
You think they're looking good for next year?
Yes.
You? Definitely. Are you a football fan?
You know, I use my dad's old method, which was you root for the Huskies in everything, and then you expand outward geographically. So you root for Seattle teams, and then if nobody from Seattle is in, you root for Oregon teams, and San Francisco is, you know,
close enough.
It's like a tsunami effect.
Yeah. But I have to admit the whole Ray Lewis energy is incredible to watch. I mean, it's something like I've never seen before in sports.
Yeah, it's fun.
I mean, it's like they're believing themselves to the Super Bowl. Well, they did already.
Yeah.
Because they were horrible at the end of the year, right?
Yeah, two seasons, as they say, right?
They stumbled into the playoffs, and look at what happened.
Are you looking forward to the Sonics? I asked you this last time, but you gave me kind of a...
Yeah, I'm going to give you a wishy-washy answer again.
Are you looking forward to a return of the Sonics?
Mr. 24-Hour Fitness is going to make an offer today.
Who?
You got some inside scoop on the Sonics?
Oh, it's been all over the news.
I missed it.
The guy from 24-Hour Fitness and two other investors, I think, are going to make
Sacramento?
Keep them in Sacramento. So it ain't over yet. That's, I guess by April we'll know. But
really, yeah. Well, you know, if you're in running 24-hour fitness, you got to be.
He's on a 24-hour schedule.
I'll toss in $50. I mean, if that.
Don't you want to see him come here?
I definitely do. I definitely do. I mean, you know how hard it is to watch the Thunder with the best record in the NBA, knowing that that was our team. Well, Wally Walker was managing, so they probably wouldn't have been that great. But that being said, that's still mostly our team, and that's hard to watch. Although I do root for them because they're the closest thing to the Sonics out there.
Yeah, I guess.
You root for Oklahoma City?
Oh, you do? I was thinking about how sad Sacramento should be. You root for Oklahoma City.
Because the players aren't the reason they left. I don't root for the owner, but...
I understand.
You know, those are our guys, man. And it's not their fault. We don't want to root against them. Now, when the Sonics get here, of course, Oklahoma who?
You are a loyal fan.
Yeah, man.
If we get the Kings and call them the Sonics...
They're still the Kings.
Do we get to hang the old Sonics banners in the...
Oh, yeah, we will. You know we will.
But then the question is, do you root for the Sonics knee Kings or do you root for the Thunder knee Sonics? You still
then I'm the new Sonics. I'm sorry. I gotta cut the Thunder loose at that point. Gotta use logic.
Yes, I hear you. I hear you. Here we are. The only other artist to reach number one on the Billboard Hot 100 from Seattle was Heart for Alone in These Dreams. Paul Revere and the Raiders for Indian Reservation.
Whoa. Which,
there you go. Wow. And the Fleetwoods, who recorded in Seattle, Come Softly to Me and Mr. Blue in 1959. Then we have Platinum Record, Baby Got Back. And now we have Macklemore.
Wait.
Did I miss anybody?
Pearl Jam didn't have a number one?
The only other artist reached number one on the Billboard Hot 100 list.
We're talking about singles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nirvana either.
I guess not.
That was a trip. Smells Like Teen Spirit never went number one.
Hot 100 is a different chart.
Yeah, that's
like
not
old alternative or whatever.
Yeah, it's their overall. How do they define their Hot 100? I'll have to look.
But now Macklemore is
number
one on the Hot 100.
Yeah,
that kid.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Wow, he really represents this town.
Does he?
Yeah, he does.
In what ways?
In every way. He's great.
Yep.
There's nobody that doesn't like him. He's a superstar.
He's proof of something I've been saying for the last 15 years, is that I thought the industry as we knew it would die, and I thought the power would be given back to the people, and he's proof of that.
Because it's his individual artistry. Yes.
Not only is it his, is he thumbs his nose at the industry with no hesitation, and I love that. Because that empowers kids that are doing music right now. They want to do it again.
Yeah, he owns his label. He owns everything about his music. Yep.
And they. They're very skillful. I mean, they are very good producers, and they control the technology really well. Is that where we're also there? Like that we're individuals control the tools?
And right now, I'm sorry. I mean, there's a lot of older artists that have, and myself included, that have a lot of talent. But if you don't have somebody dealing with your social media and really making it happen, and I mean cohesive, not going out paying some guy $1,000 to follow cool people and get you followers. You know, that's generic crap that doesn't work. But I mean, when you actually interact with your fans and you understand what they want and give it to them, it's an art in itself.
Do you both feel that it's basically up to you? It's up to you because you have so many platforms by which you can reach an audience.
Well, yeah, but as Mick says, like you have to have a social media, you have to have a savvy, and a strategy. I mean, not to turn this back around to Mick, but this situation that's happening with Glee right now, where they covered Mick's tune, that was done by they did a version of a cover song that had been done by another artist, Jonathan Colton, a friend of mine, and. And Glee kind of was they made the arrangement with Mix, but they didn't. They copied Jonathan's version, and they thought that Jonathan was just going to roll over and it would disappear. But Jonathan is a guy with an incredible social media dexterity.
Yes,
and his version is now in the top 100 on the iTunes chart, and the Glee version is somewhere down in the low 200.
But what is happening there? This is again about ownership. And, well, I guess it's about ownership, right? Who controls the product? Who controls the art?
Well, it's about two things. I mean, the song is by Mix-a-Lot. He has the ownership of the tune. And in that sense, Glee made an arrangement with him that was very old media, right? It was like contracts between two big companies. But Jonathan is an internet artist and a Twitter and Facebook artist. And his rendition of it, people, you know, it's different music. But Jonathan was able to marshal his social media people in a way that I don't think Fox anticipated.
So how do you? I know there's legal issues here, but how do you look at this larger question? I mean, you started by looking at the power of Macklemore and their ability to speak to many people.
Well, you know, in watching this and first of all, let me say the reason I can't comment on certain aspects of it is because my manager asked me not to, because we kind of have deals with both the Glee side and Jonathan side. But something, I don't know what it is with some of these larger companies. Do not underestimate a cat like Jonathan with a million followers. He will wax that ass. I mean, really, you can't underestimate that kind of power. And the best thing to do is get him on your side. You know, and that's what I mean. The industry is, as we knew it, is over. I mean, these kids are not intimidated by any large corporation. Those days are gone, and you have to understand it and get with it.
Does that mean they're not intimidated by the threats of lawsuit, or is that they it doesn't matter if you sue them because they don't have that much to lose?
I don't think Jonathan can be sued right now. He technically, has he done anything?
He hasn't, I mean, right?
No.
I'm not trying to get...
Yeah. All,
but at the same time, I don't think Jonathan has a deal with me, basically, that covers my mechanicals. And then so does Fox. So I don't understand how either one of them could be sued.
I think the threat of lawsuit is still real. But people like Macklemore and Jonathan are using social media in a way that they have direct connection with their fans. And they are subverting there's nothing illegal happening, but they are subverting the implied power that labels used to use to coerce people into just doing what they want.
Well, so take that outside of music. I mean, where does that leave us in terms of creative forces, their ability to get to audiences, and you know the whole issue of how you get paid. I mean, are we just in a new world, and it's less money, but it's more dispersed?
It's
more money with more dispersed, perhaps.
It's wide open, but people like Mix and me, who are a little bit older generation. I mean, what we need, what artists need now, is to also be able to understand and control the technology. If you're the greatest singer in the world, but you don't know how to put up a website, or you don't know how to use social media, nobody's ever going to find you.
Better hire somebody quick.
You Twitter at The Real Mix, or tweet at The Real Mix.
Yep.
You are at John Roderick. How do you use those tools to get your music out and get paid for it?
Well, you know, it's funny. Initially, I didn't really get it. So initially, you know, I start, first of all, I never paid for any followers, right? I said, I want to start from scratch and go slow. But initially, I was like, check my song out. Here's my video. Check. It didn't work. And then I realized it's not what it used to be. It used to be that an entertainer was a god. He was something you couldn't quite touch. You could kind of see him in the smoke and the lights, but he was surreal. And I realized that that's over. And these people want to engage one-on-one. So we'll talk about sports. And we'll talk about guys scratching a nutsack on a baseball diamond. I mean, and what happens is eventually you kind of create a back and forth with all your fans. And then... And only then will they say, let me check out what he's up to.
Huh.
And John is right. You have to start controlling your technology. You have to understand what ownership is about now, because it's changed. People, let's face it, 90% of the things you record in the studio, you're going to give away for free, like it or not. So you have to figure out other ways to monetize that content. And one example would be a website in which, so what? People are stealing your music. You might as well capitalize. These people can come to your website, check out all the music they want. I'm going to do a thing where I'm going to live stream my studio sessions so they can come in and comment that lyric sucks. I love the guitar riff, blah, blah, blah. So where's the money there? Well, if I can show that I have 100,000, 200,000 people and I have, you know, 20,000 watching at any time, eventually advertisers are going to go, well, wait a minute. you know, these cats are all watching Studio Gear. I own Roland, the Roland Corporation. I want to advertise my keyboards.
That's so interesting.
And that's another way of monetizing that content.
A whole different model.
It's
you have
crazy.
Like you have 20 seconds to comment on how you're doing it.
Well, I agree 100% with what Mick said. I mean, I follow him, and one thing people don't realize about Sir Mix-a-Lot is he's a nerd. He loves technology and gizmos, and he talks about it, and it's fun
yes,
to
I
just
do.
Fun to just watch him like be himself on there, and that's my model.
All right. We're all nerds. Anthony Ray, Sir Mix-a-Lot, Seattle-based rapper, number one hit. John Roderick, songwriter, podcaster, Roderick on the Line, another number one hit through the tweets coming soon.
That's right.
Thank
through
you both.
Through the tweets.
Number one tweet.
Number one tweet. I right. thank you both for
hey,
talking
Mac
to
Lamour,
us.
Hey, Mac Lamour, can I borrow about $100,000?
Yeah.
I'll get it right back to you.
He's calling you up. This is Weekday.
On 1059. A war vet who lost all four limbs in the Iraq War has had a double arm transplant. That and more of the day's news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College, now accepting applications for fall quarter admission. Evergreen offers bachelor degrees in the arts and science.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.